Welcome to Music from the Tower, highlighting the beauty of sacred and classical music. We come to you from the Tower of Hope on the magnificent campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove, California. Now, here's your host, John Romeri.
And welcome to Music from the Tower. This is John Romeri, your host, and we are here today with the two most enviable musicians in any church, in any place in the universe. They are from St. James, Los Angeles, St. James Episcopal Church in Los Angeles. It is the place this boy runs to when I need to be nourished with fabulous music. Today, we have Jim Buonamani, the director of music and the organist and organist choir master. He's actually canon, Jim Buonamani. We'll find out what that means. And we have Dr. Tom Mueller, who is the organist and 40 other different titles because he's also a professor at Concordia University here in Orange County. We're going to find out all about that. So welcome, my friends. It's so good to have you.
Thank
you.
Good
to be here.
It is great to have you. I am so nourished by the amazing things you do at St. James. So we want to tell our listeners all about that and where they can find out more. And of course, you're going to hear amazing music today on the show. So lucky listeners out there, because this place produces music like I've never heard. And believe me, I've been all over the place. And as both of you know, I try to go to every concert everywhere. I'm one of those freaky people. And whether I was living in Philadelphia or New York or wherever I landed, I went to concerts everywhere. And one of my favorite places in New York was the Church of the Ascension and the Voices of Ascension. But I'm telling you, I love your choirs. Jim, you are so talented in just turning them into this top-notch group.
John, thank you for mentioning New York, actually. When I came to St. James over 20 years ago now.
Wow. That's why it's amazing, because you've got some on.
True. It takes a long time.
It does, doesn't it?
But the rector at the time was Kirk Smith. He's now bishop in Arizona. And he said to me, it's one of the reasons I took the job. He said to me, L.A. does not have the kind of musical centers that New York has. He says, I think there's a niche here for you. He says, I would like this to be the St. Thomas Church of L.A. Well, no question that he was a little, I think, in deep water by saying that. St. Thomas's in New York is one of the great places in the world that has a boy choir school attached to it, a boarding school, and all sorts of wonderful things. We could never be at quite that level.
Well, and you don't have that. But this
we don't have that.
Adult choir beyond all telling. Yeah. It's just fabulous.
Well, what he meant was he would like to have at least that kind of excellence and that sort of English cathedral flavor. And that's something that L.A. Did not have back then. And St. James, I think, has tried to fulfill that role.
Well, under your incredible guidance, I'm no doubt.
Oh, well, thank you.
Jim and I share one nice thing, is we're both Westminster Choir College graduates.
That's right.
And, you know, there's a certain choral something, and there's certainly, at least during my time, I'm older, but during my time, English was such a bent. You know, it was all about Howells and Britten and, you know, all of these wonderful composers that this little boy from California really didn't know until my arrival at the choir college, you know. And then I hit the East Coast and, you know, started going to St. John the Divine and St. Thomas Church and the Church of the Ascension and all those great churches on the East Coast, where this was just common fare. It's the things they sang every Sunday. Mm-hmm. You know, we were so lucky and blessed as choir college students to be able to run all over New York and try to do some of that ourselves in our own parishes. But you have really accomplished it. It's so beautiful. So we want to hear a little bit about you. And, of course, part of the reason you sound so snazzy is Happy Fingers here, Dr. Tom Mueller, our wonderful organist, and who we'll say is from Orange County, but is just as a fabulous job. So we're going to talk about your organ because it's historic on this show. But, Tom, you're just an amazing young man and a fabulous organist with a pedigree a mile long, a winner of competitions and hymn playing and all sorts of other things. And you have a doctorate in organ from Eastman School.
Yeah, I was something of a latecomer to the organ. I didn't really get started until I was 14 or 15, but it's...
Brag.
Well, but I've been lucky in that I've been able to pursue, you know, serious church music and performance opportunities, as well as teaching out here in California. And, you know, my church work, especially in accompanying, is something for which I have a particular fondness.
And you jumped right to the top church in the whole Southern California area there.
Well, I was very lucky in tapping Tom when when he was applying for the position at Concordia. And his teacher, actually, at Eastman, who I went to school with, recommended him, and we just hit it off right at the beginning.
Well, and you probably studied at Notre Dame as well when you got your master's. Is that where you got your master's?
I did. So I started off at the University of Maine at Augusta, and I actually did my undergraduate in jazz piano and composition.
Well, and we should also say you teach jazz and composition and all sorts of other things at Concordia, right?
I do, yes.
Amazing.
But after I finished there, I decided that I wanted to pursue church music and organ more seriously, and so I went into the master's program at Notre Dame. And I served as one of the assistant organists at the Basilica.
Oh, how beautiful.
On the campus there. And that was a really formative experience for me, working with larger choirs and, you know, some of the masterpieces of the repertoire for the first time. Then took some time off and then went back to Eastman to pursue my DMA, and also had the opportunity there to work in a really fine church setting and to continue honing my skills as a choral accompanist.
Where'd you play in Rochester?
I was at Third Presbyterian Church in Rochester, working with Peter Dubois,
who's
another luminary of the church music radio scene.
Well,
the host of Heart and Voice.
I had a couple of wonderful students go through there, but your teacher at Notre Dame was also a choir college graduate.
And Eastman as well.
And Eastman, that's right, exactly. Yeah. So, and was Gail, his wife, still alive when you...
Yeah, I worked closely with her. And we're actually third cousins, Gail and I.
Really?
We have some common family roots in southeastern Missouri that we discovered.
Okay, so. Well, they were an incredible team, and the music there, and he's still teaching there, isn't he?
He is, yes.
Yeah, it's a great program there, and they're increasing the organ scholar from the cathedral in Arlington, who I knew very well, went to the choir college and went on and got the graduate assistantship program, I guess we should say, at Notre Dame this year. So, incredible schools. Jim, tell us a little bit about your background.
Actually, John, I don't want to forget Tom's early childhood background because it is so unusual. If you don't mind, let's go back to Tom because it is so unusual what he brings. But his childhood upbringing sort of formed a basis for what he does. Tom, do you mind sharing some of those?
Right?
Yeah. So I was born in Maine, but both of my parents are from Missouri originally, and both of them had a background, both as individuals and in their own families, playing folk music, largely bluegrass and other indigenous American styles, a lot of string instruments.
So that brought
and
you
so
to your
forth.
Jazz vibe.
Yeah, indirectly. So my earliest musical experience was hearing that sort of music played around the house. My dad had a band, and they'd often rehearse in our living room. And growing up, my siblings and I just kind of learned to play these instruments by ear. So I learned to play the fiddle, the mandolin, guitar, some banjo.
So there weren't formal lessons. You just had it.
No, we heard it and the instruments were available and it was a lot of trial and error. But looking back at it now, it was such a wonderful foundation for music education to learn to rely on your ear and to be able to figure things out intuitively rather than having to be told them and to have that sort of comfort with improvisation and playing away from the music and
so forth. Don't
you
find that there are people that come even to our choirs and they say, I don't read music. I just sing by ear. And I go, that's an incredible blessing. I can teach you to read music, but the development of the ear is an amazing thing. I had a young African-American boy that he didn't know anything. He'd never held a piece of music. And when he came to our children's choir, you know, all the auditions and all the things, he couldn't pass any of that. But he had such a developed ear that he could just do it. And once we got him into note reading, it was an amazing experience. So don't discount the fact that you've got ears out there, radio listeners.
Well, in teaching in a university setting now, you think about the undergraduate music experience and the emphasis that we put on aural skills and aural training. And for many students, that's the first time that they've had to engage with those skills.
Or think about them.
Yeah, and for many, it's a real struggle to develop that. So I was very fortunate in that I was exposed to that and thinking about that unconsciously from the age of 4 or 5.
Wow. And it's no doubt made you an incredibly strong musician.
It's a great
background.
We're going to
hear a lot more about that coming up. But why don't we hear you play a piece? This is an actual arrangement of a Poulenc piece. Tell us about it.
So what we're going to hear is a piece that Poulenc, Francis Poulenc, the French composer of the 20th century, originally composed as incidental music for a ballet that was being produced in Paris in the 1930s. And it was scored for a small chamber ensemble. And the inspiration for this suite of pieces, the Suite Française, was a collection of 16th century Renaissance dances that was published in Paris. And so he was taking these early French dances and rearranging them with his own unique harmonic and rhythmic idiom. And they're really delightful in the original scoring. He later rearranged them for solo piano, and they were republished as solo keyboard works. And so my arrangement and adaptation of these really takes elements of both of the different versions, the small wind ensemble as well as the solo keyboard version, and then adapts it to the organ and the sort of sounds and colors we have.
And is this you playing at St. James? Where was this recorded?
So this is a recording from a recital at St. James in early 2015, and you'll hear many of the different colors and dynamics that this instrument is capable
of. We'll talk
of.
A lot more about that instrument coming up, but here we are, a little Francis Poulenc by Dr. Tom Mueller, and we'll be back with both Tom and Jim in our next segment. Don't go away. Welcome back to Music from the Tower. This is John Romeri, and I've got these two amazing musicians here in the studio today, Jim Buonamani from St. James, Canon Jim Buonamani, and organist choirmaster there, and Dr. Tom Mueller. We just heard a little bit about Tom in the last segment, especially his background in jazz and coming into music. Didn't start the organ till 12 years old, but we were just hearing a little bit of a fanfare for a common man, and this was you playing, right, Jim?
Yes, this is the very famous fanfare by Aaron Copland. I think most of your listeners would recognize this piece. And here it was arranged for the organ at St. James.
Was it your arrangement?
It was.
Wow.
And it was arranged specifically in the year 2000, because it was in that year that we installed a new division of trumpet pipes on the organ. And these are called trumpet enchamade pipes.
The ones that stick out, right?
The ones that
go horizontally out.
Exactly, horizontal rather than vertical. And they developed over centuries, particularly in the 18th century, became sort of this commanding fanfare sound of the organ on high wind pressures and so forth in the 19th century particularly. So we decided that St. James's organ needed these.
Oh, of course. Every organ does. We've got sets to burn in Hazel.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's what that was. And that these trumpet pipes were actually built by the Austin Organ Company when it was still under the direction of the voicer David Broom. So the unusual thing about them is we actually have two sets. One set is brass, polished. The other set is copper polished. So when you are in the church and you're looking at these magnificent reeds under our west window, you'll see both of these. And it's quite exceptional to have a chamade rank of both metals.
And they produce different sounds, right?
Exactly. One is much brighter and snappier than the other, and it's nice to have the variety.
Well, and that whole back case, you must go to St. James, because the whole back case, the whole church is beautiful, but the back organ case is just gorgeous. It's a little miniature, just gorgeous instrument.
Well, we have also back there a small, what we call antiphonal positive organ, and that's the case that has some gold leafing on it, and it's a rather small division, but behind that are the commanding trumpet enchamades.
Well, the whole organ there is just magnificent. But before we get to that, let's talk a little bit about your background and where you came into music.
Well, I grew up, John, in Rochester, New York, and where Eastman School of Music is located, and that's actually where I did get my bachelor's degree. But I grew up about four or five houses away from Sacred Heart Cathedral there.
Wow, okay.
And at that time, there was a gentleman there named William Ferris, and you probably know of this man.
Right, William Ferris, who really became the most famous by his William Ferris Chorale in Chicago.
Well, in Chicago, that's where he hailed from, and he went to Sacred Heart in the mid-60s and developed the program there, and I was growing up there. And interestingly enough, do you know the name Fulton J. Sheen?
Of course, all of our listeners out there.
Right, Archbishop Sheen. Well,
who was here on the campus with Robert Schuller in the early days of the Hour of Power.
I'm sure
one of the
was.
First real guests on TV.
Well, that's right. And Sheen had his own television show.
Right, he was very
one of the first. Yeah, one of the first clergy persons to do that. Interestingly enough, he became Bishop of the Diocese of Rochester for a short period of time.
I didn't know that at all.
Yeah, and for about a 5-6 year period. And it was actually during the period that William Ferris was there. So Sacred Heart Cathedral became this bastion not only of great music, which Bishop Sheen loved and fostered with Bill Ferris, but also Sheen was extremely sensitive to the liturgy, to drama, to the power of the liturgy. So as a kid, and at that time I was about 10 years old or so, that was my first influence, hearing music in this grand setting, a mystical sort of setting, otherworldly setting, really got my juices flowing, shall we say.
Okay.
And I realized that this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So I have literally from 10 years of age not wanted to do anything else. And I don't think that's particularly unusual for a lot of church
musicians.
No, we've
heard that from guest after guest, you know. And as we now, as church musicians, as big boys, grown up, you know, we have to constantly think about that, don't we?
Right.
I remember my first experience was going into Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. Mm. That's where I grew up. And hearing that organ and Richard Purvis playing that, you know, that did it for me.
Yep.
It was like, wow, if I could ever be in a place like that. And lucky me, I've had a couple of places like that.
Yeah.
You know, so it's all of us have that responsibility who are in fabulous positions now to inspire that next generation, don't we? We have to make sure that what we do is so beautiful and so amazing that on hearing it, someone says, I'd like to do that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I just can't get over how amazing that is.
Well, and I'm sure you can share the stories of students of yours and chorus members of yours that have gone into church music or other fields of music because of your influence. It's one of the greatest gifts, actually, that I feel in this business is seeing somebody else take it over and being energized.
Yes.
And
I have one of those right here. One of my former students, David Ball, is our associate director of music here and an organist. And he was just a little high school kid who was kind of reluctant to go to the organ. You know, his parents said, well, let's try it for a month, but he doesn't seem interested. You know, well, by the end of the month, I had him hooked, you know.
And look at him
he'd
now.
He'd been a member of my choir forever, you know. But we all have those stories of people we've touched. When was your first experience on the organ?
Well, so William Ferris, who was the organist at Sacred Heart, was also a very famous composer.
Yes,
so
in Chicago with his choruses.
Yeah, and so it was when I was about 11 years old that my music teacher, I used to plunk around on the piano a lot when I was young, and I would compose these little ditties. And my music teacher at the school, one of the nuns actually at the time, saw something in me, and she said, well, we're coming up to a special celebration, the school feast day, St. Joseph's Day, and I'd like you to write a piece for that celebration.
Oh, is that great?
And she says, you can write it in two different ways. She says, if you'd like, you can write a piece for our school band, which I wasn't particularly interested in at the time, especially when she said, or you could write it for the organ in the cathedral, and our organist, William Ferris, will be glad to play it.
Wow.
So I thought, that was so exciting. And it was soon after the organ was put in there. At that time, it was a big organ built by an Illinois firm called Wicks. Mm-hmm. They now have a different organ there. But it was an exciting instrument. It had a trumpet on chamois that was very impressive.
Did you include that in your piece for St. Joseph?
Not in particular, because I didn't really know much about the organ at all when I wrote this piece. But I met with Bill, and he showed me the organ, and he demonstrated it for me, and so I could learn how to write for it. And so I produced something, and he played it. And after that, he said to me, would you like to learn how to play the organ? And I said,
He hooked me right in.
And it was actually within a year that I became his assistant there.
Still in grade school.
Yeah.
And had you already studied the piano?
Yes.
Yeah, great. Yeah.
Not a lot, but enough to know the keyboard, and that's so important for an organist.
Wow. Those are wonderful stories, aren't they? Just all of that. And Tom, when did you first come to the organ?
My earliest experience of the organ was actually from my grandmother, who was a rather amateur-level church organist, but she had studied in college in the 1940s at Concordia University in Seward, Nebraska, which was a teacher's college at the time. And she passed her love of the organ and of the piano and of church music on to my father, who would also play piano and play a lot of hymns. And he also loved to listen to some of the old E. Power Biggs and Virgil Fox recordings. So I always sort of had that sound in my ears. So I started playing the piano when I was about 11 or so, but I, really got into it with the hope of eventually studying the organ once my legs were long enough to actually reach the pedal board.
We've had several people say that. I played the piano as long as I could, but finally my legs were long enough and I could play the organ.
So when I was about 14 or so, I was introduced to the organist at the local Episcopal parish, who was a wonderful organist and pianist and composer named Alan Wingard. He's still living in Maine and actively composing. I loved him from the beginning because he looked just like Obi-Wan Kenobi. We auditioned and I played the piano, and he walked over to the organ, which was a small, early 19th century American organ, very small, typical New England organ. And he played the Bach jig fugue. And that was it. I was a goner at that point.
These are great stories. I love all of these. And both of you, and not only are amazing organists and amazing musicians in every single way, but you're both composers and arrangers. Jim, you've written some wonderful choral pieces that I've enjoyed, and I'm sure have written other things. We'll find out more about that. Tom, this is a little bit more of your Poulenc arrangement. This is the fifth movement of that Suite Francaise. Tell us just a little bit about this movement, and we'll give it a listen.
This movement is one of the slower movements from this overall set, and it gives a wonderful demonstration of some of the different colors of the organ. Many of these are meant to imitate some of the characteristic woodwind timbres that are found in the original, and so we'll hear in succession the strings, some of the softer reeds, a crescendo, and then a slow fade out with some of the strings, and even the chimes and the harp at the very end.
You can tell that these are amazing people, and we're going to hear a lot more from them, and a lot more about their program at St. James. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Music from the Tower. This is John Romeri, and we are so excited here on the campus just to have you on the campus, leave alone on our radio show. Jim Buonamani, and Tom Mueller, both musicians of extraordinary talent and both musicians at St. James. We've just heard a little bit of the Alain Dances, a wonderful organ piece by Jean Alain, and this was Tom playing at St. James.
This is another recital recording, I believe, from early 2015. And for me, playing this sort of French repertoire from the 20th century on this organ really demonstrates the flexibility and the power of this instrument, the ability to play all sorts of repertoire and to play it really convincingly and well.
The organ at St. James is magnificent, and the way it accompanies the choir, we're going to hear a piece a little bit later, and really shows off the way the organ just integral with the choral anthems that you produce. But tell us a little bit about the organ there and its history.
Well, the Los Angeles organ builder, Murray Harris, is the guy that built this organ, and it was actually built in 1911, before the building was built, because it was originally built for St. Paul's Cathedral in downtown L.A.
Okay.
Actually, it was a parish church first and then became a cathedral. That was torn down, and in the 20s, a new cathedral, even a bigger cathedral, an Episcopal cathedral, was built, and the organ was moved there and enlarged. And Murray Harris studied on the East Coast with George Hutchings, an organ builder whose training was in England. So Murray Harris had, for his aesthetic, that English cathedral sound.
And it certainly has that.
And that's what he's brought to St. James.
And when did it move to St. James?
Well, it is an interesting story. So the St. Paul's Cathedral in the 20s lasted for up until the 70s, early 70s, the diocese decided to tear it down due to structural earthquake damage.
Mm.
So luckily, another very familiar name to L.A. Organ people is Manuel Rosales.
Yes, how lucky we are. He's right here in Southern California.
Yeah. Have you had him on your show?
Not yet, but we're going to.
Oh, I bet. Well, Manuel convinced the powers that be at the cathedral to save the organ. So the bishop, I think it was Bishop Rusak at the time, agreed, and they put the organ into storage until they could figure out what to do with it. Well, it sort of languished in storage for another 20 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And then in the early 90s, late 80s, actually, they decided that St. James Church would be the place for it to go. Now, my predecessor, David Falconer, was sort of instrumental with Manuel to have that happen. St. James's Kimball organ was deteriorating at the time, and so this was sort of the perfect solution.
Well, how providential.
So they actually gave the organ to St. James at no cost except to remove it, but it did cost a lot of money to rebuild it.
Refurbish it.
Mm-hmm. And the Amundsen Foundation was instrumental in providing the funds to do that. And so it finally resurrected in 1995. It took a number of twists and turns. There was one company, Schlicker Organ Company, that went bankrupt during the time. And then the Austin Organ Company took it over. And there was quite a lot of drama going on. But finally, it got together. And in 1995, it was installed. And Manuel Rosales oversaw all of this. And it's a beautiful instrument. We're very fortunate to have it.
It's just gorgeous. And we've heard it a little bit on recordings, and we're going to hear a little bit more of it coming up. But the whole program there often can be built around a fabulous instrument, isn't it? I find that time and time again when parishes say, oh, we don't have the money for a nice organ, or we're not even putting in an organ. We just dedicated a church here in Orange County. No organ, no provisions for an organ. You know, and it's an organ that attracts quality musicians like you. It's a beautiful pipe organ and an instrument that attracts those musicians. Nobody's going to go to school for 8 years and then come out and play a 20-year-old Allen or a little Clavinova keyboard, my friends. It's absolutely essential that we have a fabulous instrument.
Well, you know, the Amundsen Foundation, and I want to mention Lee Walcott, who was managing director at the time and an organist himself. He really was the one that took the interest in this. But he said, if we're going to do this, we really want this organ to be available to the community, not just for services at St. James, not just for worship, but in recitals. So for the last 20, over 20 years, we have had what we call the International Laureates Organ Recital Series. And this presents organists from all around the world. All of the finest organists have played on this instrument. And it's really part of the vision of Lee Walcott and the Amundsen Foundation that we keep that organ music alive. And we're very excited that we were able to do that. Now, one of your people, David Ball, will be on our series.
He's coming up in January, right?
January 14, I believe it is.
I think so.
At 6 o'clock.
At 6 o'clock.
6 o'clock.
The organ recitals.
The recitals always follow Evensong.
And they're at 4:30.
And they're at 4:30.
Second Sunday, usually?
Second Sunday of the month, October through May. And for your listeners who don't know what Evensong is, would that be something you'd like me to...
Well, we would call it evening prayer, probably, as Roman Catholics.
It's the Anglicans have sort of put Vespers and Compline, a couple of the other monastic offices, together.
Together. Well, we all do. You know?
Yeah.
We're
yeah.
not meeting nine times a day anymore.
Exactly,
you know?
Yeah.
So, but it's so beautiful, my friends. If you have not been to Evensong at St. James, it's one of my favorite things. I look forward to it every single month. And the few times I can't get to Los Angeles from Orange County because I've got some crazy thing here at Christ Cathedral that precludes it, I'm so disappointed because it feeds me forever. A few months ago, we had the Howells Festival. Your Magnificat that we're going to hear at the end of this segment was one of the most beautiful renditions. I've heard King's College sing this, and this was more beautiful, Jim. It was fabulous.
Oh, thank you, John. Well, that piece
and
in
Tom
particular.
Plain. It was amazing.
Tom Plain, and with that organ and that acoustic. And I'd have to say, you know, St. James Church originally was a very dry building, had no acoustic whatsoever. And as you know,
that makes it tough.
Deadly for an organ or for choral music.
Well, a lot of these pieces were envisioned with that part of the building.
Exactly.
You know?
With those grand cathedral spaces, right? So when we put in the organ in the 90s, we hardened the surfaces. We did quite a bit of work to increase the reverberation period in the church.
It's a pleasure.
And it's nice now.
It's very beautiful. The service is beautiful. It's so thoughtful and well-crafted. The choir is absolutely magnificent. How do you get these amazing singers? And why don't I have them?
No. Well, we share them.
All right. Choir envy came out there, didn't it?
Well, you know, I went and talked with a dear colleague of mine a number of years back when I first started here in L.A., Tom Foster. Do you know Tom?
Yes.
He's now up in Seattle area, and he was for organist for over 20 years at All Saints Beverly Hills. Another
also
iconic
one of the great
place.
Places.
Yep. He did an amazing job.
Recordings of that choir forever.
Right. But I remember asking him the same thing. I said, Tom, your choir is so beautiful. How have you done it? And he basically just told me, he said, work there 20 years and you'll get there.
Yeah, that's the deal. Well, I've been here 2 years and I must say, ours is getting better every hour. But it does take time, doesn't it?
It does take time.
I was 20 years in Pittsburgh, and I had some pretty good choirs when I left.
That's right.
And 19 years in St. Louis, and the choirs were amazing there, too. Didn't quite have that in Philadelphia.
It's sort of a catching thing, too. You know, when you have a certain sound, say you get one individual singer who produces exactly the sound that you're after, if others can hear that person,
right,
they begin to imitate it.
Right. And that's kind of a vote for staff singers, isn't it?
Yeah.
Here at Christ Cathedral, we have 12. But finding those is not easy because I'm not looking for just any good singer.
Well, particularly
I'm looking for a certain sound, you know.
In Southern California, they don't have that English cathedral or choral experience that the East Coast has.
Right.
Although that's changing.
It might not be in their head, you know. It might not be in their head. But it certainly is more and more, you know.
It is. That is changing.
It's mm-hmm. wonderful. And the Evensong's 4:30 organ recitals, 6 o'clock.
That's right. Second Sunday
of the month.
Now, December is something a little different.
Yes. Tell us about the December lessons.
Yeah. In December, we replace Evensong with Advent Lessons in Carol service. This is similar to the Christmas lessons and carols that you many people know from King's College, Cambridge.
Yes. We all start our Christmas Eves with that.
Right. And This is actually another service that the dean of King's College, way back in the 30s, decided to start, and it's an Advent service. So it's not Christmas music. It's really in expectation of Christmas, so it's Advent music. And so we do that on the second Sunday of Advent this year, and in place of Evensong.
At 4:30.
It's lovely, and it goes through lessons, of the redemption of the world through Christ, and music appropriate to the period. And it's a little Christmassy flavor, but yeah, we're not quite there yet, so we try to avoid some of that.
Well, and here is a little bit of the Howells Magnificat. This is from the Collegium Regale, and it's Tom playing, Jim conducting, and the St. James Choir. Is this live from the performance I attended?
Yes, it is. This is exactly what you heard, and it's one of the first pieces that Herbert Howells wrote for the church of that magnitude, and started his whole series of canticle writings.
One of the great pieces.
1945.
So we'll be right back with a whole lot more about St. James' program and about church music. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to our last segment of Music from the Tower. We are here today with Jim Buonamani, with Dr. Tom Mueller, and what a pleasure to have you both here with us. We've just been listening to a little bit of I Wonder As I Wander. That's a carol from last year's lessons, right, Jim?
Isn't that a beautiful Appalachian tune, isn't it, Tom?
Yeah.
And a gorgeous setting. I heard it live last year at the carols.
A wonderful young musician, composer, and arranger. He's Aaron McDermid is his name, and he's actually the brother of one of my singers, Brett McDermid.
So that's how you came to get that arrangement.
And the soloist, if you heard the tenor soloist down there, it was Jimmy Traum, another one of my wonderful singers. So music today is going strong in choral settings and arranging, I think, has never been any stronger than it is going right now.
I think there's some beautiful work being done. Mm-hmm. I have a choral series with Morningstar that I edit, and the submissions to me are amazing. You know, they're really some great composers sending me things that, you know, have found their way into the catalog, and mm-hmm. and choirs are out there singing them. You know, it's not the case everywhere. But and you're teaching composition at the university, right, Tom?
I do. So my role at the university in a relatively small music department is primarily to teach church music, but different facets of it. So I teach private applied organ lessons. I also teach some of our academic church music coursework, courses in liturgy, liturgical theology, church music history, and so forth. But I also have the pleasure of teaching composition, and many of my students do want to pursue choral sacred composition. So it's wonderful to actually have a hand in training the next generation of composers and seeing the works that they produce, as well as the many performance opportunities that they have to hear these works done with our university ensembles.
Yeah, so they actually have a little laboratory for them to be able to hear their pieces performed.
It's one of the great advantages of studying music, and especially composition, in a university setting.
Well, and having a great teacher driving the bus. That's a very, very good thing. And do you find that a lot of organists tend to do composition? Here we are with two of the finest organists in Southern California, and you both do arranging and composition. Do you think some of that comes from just our constant need to improvise and sort of compose on the spot? You know, I find that many of the things that I've written actually started as some improv that I thought, well, that was kind of cool, and I write it all down, you know?
You know, I think that's very true, John. I also think that the church requires so much music, incidental music. It's almost like writing for film or for plays. I mean, sometimes you have a psalm setting for a specific occasion, And you need to write something for specific forces. Say you hire a brass quartet and you can't find just the right setting for it. Well, many musicians that have the interest in writing music will say, I'll write my own. And that's what I've done a lot through the years. Tom, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's certainly been my experience as well. And I think, you know, to have that sort of training and interest is so invaluable for a church musician for exactly the reasons that Jim said. If you have specific forces or a particularly strong musician that you want to showcase, to have the ability to craft something that will perfectly fit with the rest of the liturgy and the rest of the music and with the forces available.
And let's not forget that J.S. Bach wrote weekly all of his cantatas.
Because of need. Palestrina, so did all
of
them.
So it's a long tradition of this sort of thing happening.
And how cool that your university sees that and, you know, assigns you to that. Because as the composition teacher, you can help them select texts that would be usable in the liturgy. You have that ability to say, well, okay, that went on for 12 minutes, but the average anthem is about 5. You know? So is it usable? Is it anything that could be used somehow in the liturgy? Is there life? You know, one of the hardest things about being liturgical musicians is that constant repetition. And can the music, that's always one of my criteria in selecting pieces for my choral series, is can this piece bear the test of time? It sounds fabulous on first hearing, and then about 6 times into it, it's like, well, okay, that's worn thin. And I think so many of our church musicians, at least in my opinion, or in my experience as diocesan director of music, and seeing what my parish musicians in Philadelphia, I had 300 parishes I was in charge of, in terms of helping the musicians and guiding them in all sorts of ways. But seeing the kind of choices they did, they came from demo tapes. You know, oh, I found that at a reading session, and I thought that was going to be a great piece, you know. And 6 weeks into it, 5 masses a weekend, I couldn't stand to sing that Holy, Holy one more time, you know, because the music is flashy and dashy, but it doesn't have enough musical substance to sustain the repetition that liturgy demands.
Well, we've seen so much of this in the 70s and 80s.
Yes.
60s, too, you know, post-Vatican II.
And do you find that that's changing, too, that the music has more substance and there's more music to really choose from as a church musician in choosing music of the 20th century?
I certainly feel that way. The young composers that are coming to light now, you have people like, I think Ola Jalo, the Norwegian composer who lives in Manhattan now, will be listening.
Stuff, doesn't he?
Will be listening, I think, to his lovely Salve Regina.
Yes, we're going to sign
off
with that today.
Yeah. But there are many composers that are now really injecting a sort of a mysticism and a spirituality, an otherworldliness, shall we say, in their music. And you know what? I have to say that the L.A. composer that is beloved, Morten Lauridsen, has a lot to do with this. He's not specifically a church musician. In fact, he's not a church musician at all. But
he tackled liturgical texts.
He has tackled some, and they've become such important pieces throughout the world now and well-known, and many composers are taking that sort of sound world, that mystical quality, and working with it. And I think this is precisely what the church needs right now, is music that's going to help glimpse the divine, you know, help people to...
I think so many people are searching for that.
Yeah.
And I see it in the young people. You know, the young people are not looking for some happy, clappy little thing that they can join into and sounds just like the stuff they listen to on the radio. They want to come to the liturgy and hear a piece that takes them elsewhere.
Yeah.
We all do. You know, and some of the people who were, I would call, songwriters, right, and they had a very cool little melody in their head and actually did us a tremendous disservice in the Catholic Church, at least, by jury-rigging with our liturgical texts, because the liturgical text didn't happen to fit the cool little melody they had in their head. Because they weren't composers, they had melodies, and these melodies and whatever chord went underneath it often changed our, you know, glory to God in the highest, glory, glory. All right, well, that's not the real liturgical text. And a composer, I think of the Anglican Church and the Magnificat setting. There are 5,000 settings of the Magnificat, and the text is exactly the same.
You know, I often wondered when the Roman Catholic Church switched to the vernacular, and here in the States, you know, using English, that they didn't use the Anglican Church as a model, because they had we've had 500 years to work with these English texts, and composers had to struggle the same way make them work.
But they were composers, so they had the whole body of musical knowledge behind them. So they had a musical bag of tricks to come with. You know, whereas if you're just a songwriter and you maybe play guitar or something, you don't have those musical skills. Mm-hmm. I just was a participant, a very fortunate participant in a conference in Rome. There were about 350 of us invited to go to Rome from all over the world. And the whole crux of it was 50 years ago to that date of that conference was when the vernacular began. And it opened an entire can of worms in the church no one could have anticipated. And a lot of it had to do with cultures. You know, all of a sudden now you could sing in Vietnamese or you could sing in Spanish. Until that time, churches in Vietnam were singing in Latin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was a whole different repertoire. Now the music of the day and the language of the day, but mostly the musical culture of the different nations, could also come right in the door and into liturgy. And it kind of took us away from that divine, that sublime moment of being outside the world. Now we were sort of inside the world. It came right in the door with us. You know, so it really gave us a whole different world. When I go to St. James Evensong, I'm taken right out of my cares and woes of Christ's Cathedral and sent right into absolute, sublime, divine time, because the choir and the music is so beautiful there. And I thank both of you for that. It's an amazing gift you've given to all of us. So those of you out in Radio Land, if you have not been to St. James or other places like that, but especially St. James Episcopal in Los Angeles, please make yourself available for that. I often end the show with a little tagline, come back next week. We'll see you next week. But in the meantime, go listen to live performance. Well, my friends, if you have not heard live music performance at St. James, you haven't lived yet. So get yourself over there. Thank you, Jim Guadamani. Thank you, Tom Mueller. We will no doubt have both of you back often, often, often.
A pleasure. Thank you, Jim.
Just wonderful to have you.
Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. And this is a little piece. This is the Yalo.
Yes, Yalo. He titles it Second Eve, and it's actually the text of the Salve Regina.
Salve Regina. So thanks for listening. Again, this is Music from the Tower with John Romeri, and we will see you next week. Thanks for listening.